You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, welcome back to Tzohar LaMikra, the Hebrew in Israel Weekly podcast with Yoel Halevi. Hope people are enjoying these programs, and I'm going to try as much as I can to put these out every week. This week, I'm having a little difficulty with all the things that I have to do, but thank God I found a few moments to be able to record this recording. In any case, this week we have a few very interesting sections in this parasha. We are in Parashat Shelach, and the parasha speaks about the spies and what happens with when they go through the land and the whole argument over the land, and obviously these stories can also echo into our times, for example, with the nonsense of the BDS and Israelis support helping the BDS and so on. As a friend of mine said to me last week, you know, the Torah has eternal messages, things keep on repeating themselves, and I think that this story is used all the time to indicate the concept of traitors and people who speak ill of the land. And so on. And really, you know, when you think about it, everything that happens in the news, the way Israel is depicted in the news is usually very different than what's really going on. It's not a war zone. There aren't people blowing themselves up in the middle of the street and stuff like that. You know, Israel is a young country with a lot of historical enemies and so on. And obviously people are going to continue this type of spreading of lies about Jews in Israel all the time, because it's, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years of history don't vanish off the face of the earth in 5 minutes. Even if you're an amazing country, still, it's going to carry on. So, you know, the story of the spies is something that continues to this very day. But for this week, I actually want to focus on something a little different, a subject that every time I speak with people about, no one actually knows what it is. And it's one of these commandments that people don't really think about, but people have this activity in their lives every single day. What I'm talking about is in Numbers 15, verses 17 to 21, it says the following, Vaydaber Adonai Moshe Lemon, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, Vamarta Alehem, and you will say to them, Bevoachem el haaretz asher ani mevi etchem shama. When you come or arrive in the land or to the land, which I bring you there, vaya ba'ochlechem milechem haaretz tarim u'turma la'adonai. And it will be that when you eat from the, and I'm specifically going to translate here, bread of the land, you will raise a turma, which is a lifting, which is a type of, I can't really call it a tithe, because there's tithes and then there's turma, there's ma'aser and then there's turma. And a turma comes from the root rum, which is really similar to the root ramam, and similar to the word harem, which is to lift. So it's actually a lifting. And because it doesn't have the term ma'aser, it doesn't really have any specific size. A ma'aser is a tenth, comes from the word eser, but this is a turma. And when the Torah uses the term turma, it's really something that's given to the Kohen. A ma'aser, a tithe, is given to the Levite. A turma is given to a Kohen. And so you give this turma, and it's given to la'adonai, to the Lord, which is obviously something which indicates also to give to a Kohen, because the moment you give it to God, it's really automatically given to a Kohen. But what is this, why do I say specifically lechem? Why does he translate specifically bread? And why do I actually raise this thing, why I specifically translate bread? Is because lechem, as I've mentioned in my blog, lechem can mean other things as well. Lechem can actually mean food in general. The same way, for example, corn used to be in Old English, most forms of grain. But then it says in verse 20, Reshit arisotechem hala tarimu teruma. Reshit, again, the term Reshit is like Bereshit, the first, the beginning. And it is, but also Reshit can mean the prime, the best of something. And Reshit arisotechem and arisa, in modern Hebrew means a crib, but really an arisa means the bowl that you use to knead your dough. So it's the first of the bowl. Chala tarimu turma. This will be a chala. Now, chala is a term that we find in Leviticus of a type of bread. And chala seems to be from the word halul. This is apparently a thick bread And the reason I say halul is there's a dagesh in the lamed that indicates that the root is chet lamed lamed, which means halal, and halal could mean either someone who's been killed in the field, which means someone who's a dead body, but killed in battle. But halal can also mean something that has holes in it. This is actually a thick type of bread. And really what we're talking about here is what people eat in everyday life. You know, people might eat flatbreads as well, but most people want to eat normal bread that's kind of raised and so on. And even if you eat flatbreads, flatbreads can also go through a leavening process. So still, even flatbreads still have a bit of a puffiness to them and holes in them. And it says, Tarimu Truma, you take from this bread and you do a Truma. You actually take a section of your bread and you give it to a Kohen. And it says, Ketumat Goren Ken Tarimu Ota. The same way you do a Truma from the Goren, which Goren is really where you work your grains. And the golem is like the threshing floor, but it's, you know, all the process that you go through when you process grains, ken tarim ota, you will raise it the same way. And this is actually a commandment that's actually ignored by a lot of people, because really in everyday life, you make, you know, you, for example, you bake bread every day or every week or something, or you run a bakery and so on. You're going to have to start taking bread every time, try to find a Kohen, and give it to him. And this is not always a simple thing to do. And there are questions of the practicality of this practice, because even back in, you know, the judges' time, the first temple times, Kohens were not that common. I mean, today we have an unusual situation where technically there are more Kohanim than Levim, and that raises a big question about how can such a thing actually happen. But what we actually have here is a commandment that when you make bread, and this also obviously bivochem el haaretz, okay, when you arrive in the land. So I'm not expecting people to do this outside of the land, though in Jewish customs, in Jewish custom practice, it is done, but it's more of a memorial when it's done outside the land. It's usually burnt. It's just a memorial, and because a kohen has to be clean to eat this, then it has to be burnt. But for example, most religious Jews here in Israel, if not all, and most kosher factories, if not all, actually take a section out of the dough that they produce and they put it aside and they burn it. Now, because there's no specific quantity in the Torah, one can assume it can also be the size of a small roll or something if you're dealing with a large quantity, or even a small piece just so you can put it aside. Though I strongly disagree with the idea of taking a small piece out of it, because it has to be a quantity that someone can sit down and eat. So it must be something the size at least of a minimal of a small roll. But the point is that I, from what I've understood throughout the years, most people are very unaware of this commandment. That they grow over it, they read it, but no one really actually does anything about it. And this is, but again, as I said, I think this command is limited to the land, the same way that mostly tithes and things of that nature are limited to the land. And obviously, if someone decides to tithe, it's something that if they don't live in the land, it's something they do from their free will. So this is, again, this practice of taking a part of the dough and giving it to a Kohen is part of the entire system of tithing of sorts. But again, as I said, it's not ma'aser, it's a truma. So in practicality, what's done in Judaism is inside the land, you take a piece and you burn it. It was a time where they did two. Outside of the land, they will do two. One is a memorial that's actually given to a Kohen, as not really the chala. The term used in Judaism is chala, though chala just means a type of bread, but the trumat chala, we'll call it, was given to a Kohen to continue a practice, of a memorial of the practice, where this piece is actually not the real one, but just to keep the memory of this action. And another one was to pull out, which was the actual one, and burn it. And it depends if you lived in certain borders, and there's all these divisions of borders where you live and so on. If you want to see more details, you can actually go to the tractate of Chala in the Mishnah and see all the different descriptions there. But what really kept in the end, people said, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing all these different things? So at one point it kind of stopped and everyone just took a small piece and burnt it as the memorial, and that was it. But in any case, as I said, I personally think it's limited to just to the land. And I don't think you have to do outside the land, but, you know, just to be aware of it. Another very important command that we have in this parasha is the tzitzit. And I've spoken about tzitzit in other places as well. I've written about this and so on. So there's a few details about the concept of tzitzit. First of all, tzitzit comes from the root tzitz or tzutz, related to the word tzatz, which is to sprout. And really, tzitzit was basically kind of seen as something that sprouts out of one's clothing and almost like a flower. And when you look at ancient Mesopotamian inscriptions, war reliefs, and you see the way many of them had the tzitzit, there were two things that you had on the clothing. One was like these fringes all over the place, on all the edges. And these were just fringes. These were part of the decor of the garment, usually because you don't have to finish a garment with we do today with clean lines and everything's folded and sewed together to make it look pretty. They used to do little knots and just have, you know, instead of having to go the whole hassle of sewing it, they just left a lot of strings out from the garment itself. And that was actually sometimes exploited to make tzitzit. Basically, you just took a whole bunch of them and you wrapped it together. You actually braided it together with a blue thread. And sometimes blue thread was actually part of the garment itself. You incorporated one point inside the garment, and then you just had to make sure it's on four corners. And what we also find is more elaborate ones where you have this long cord and it ends with like a flower and they have this sprouting at the end, which really does fit the concept of tzitzit, as in the eye of tzitz. And so on. If you look at the root, you can find in several places in the Tanakh where it's a flowering. This is why some assume that the tzitz of the Kohen Gadol, the gold plate that the high priest has, really was more like a flowery type of thing, or maybe some of the decor was more like flowers. And what we also have here is that the text here also adds the tchelet. And tchelet, really, there's a debate that I argue about this, that tchelet doesn't necessarily have to be a colorant, meaning it has to come from a specific animal. It was just a blue. It was any type of blue. And then you have all the debates. Is it blue? Is it green? Is it turquoise? Is it purple? But looking at everything that we find from the ancient Near East, it's very clear the colors were red, blue, sometimes a little bit of yellow and things like that. But white, red, and blue were very, very common as colors that we find. We have wall reliefs that actually give us depictions of what people wore. Especially, people were called Asians. You know, in the Egyptian reliefs, obviously, when you say Asians, what they're talking about is everyone that lives from Sinai onwards, which are not African and not European and not Arabian. So this would also include anyone who lived in Canaan. And you have in these wall reliefs people that actually look, some of them look very, very Jewish, especially I'm talking about slightly darker colored Jews. And what they have on their clothing is actually on four corners. Now, when I say corners, it's not like two in the front, two in the back. It's like on four sections of the clothing. And you see four little fringes wounded together, braided together. And at least one of the strings is blue. And I think it's very clear that what we're looking at are actually Israelites. The way they look, the depiction that we find of what Israelites look like from different periods, it seems to be very clear the Egyptians gave us a color description, very detailed description of what Israelites actually looked. And it's very clear that majority of people were probably dark skinned, but not very, very dark, not super dark like you have, for example, in some Yemenite Jews. We're talking about people variated in colors in general, skin tones, but in general, people were relatively dark, which is very common in a sunny area like the Mediterranean. But what's really focused here is the tzitzit that they wear, and actually where they position them, because the text says that they have to be on, it says, and kanfe bigdehem ledorotam. You know, they wear these on the kanaf, and kanaf is usually translated as the corner, but corner kanaf can really mean the edge. And this is why it's quite plausible to argue that people just put it in four positions on the clothing and it didn't really matter where. And there's an interesting idea as well that the tzitzit was really something that was a reminder, but also that the clothing was some kind of a border of the personality, where you're wrapped in your clothing because you yourself are the naked body. And then you're wrapped in clothing and the clothing is one border, which is the border of society, but then the tzitzit added on is the divine border. It goes together with your clothing, reminding you it's not just you as a human being with another human being hiding your nakedness from another person. On this hiding of the nakedness, which reminds us a little bit of what happened with Adam and Eve, you also have the border between you and God, the reminder that you are in front of God, that you will not fall off this kind of this border that you're on, which you know, your barrier, which you know, which is your clothing, which carry the tzitzit. And the regarding the issue itself, it's of tchelet, as I said, there are depictions of what the color was, but then there's the whole debate of it didn't necessarily have to come from a murex and so on. And for example, one of the arguments that's used to prove that Israelites actually didn't necessarily have to wear a blue thread that's made from the murex, for example, which is a very common creature that it has a gland that we can produce a color from. And it was very, very common for this gland to be used, especially in Cyprus and the Phoenicians. They were very, very good in this. So we know that this type of colorant was actually used in the ancient world and was probably also used by Israelites. But the Egyptians, for example, couldn't produce this because the Egyptians mostly used linen. And this colorant, the chemical structure of the colorant doesn't really cling to linen. And it seems to be, at least in my opinion, that the tabernacle was mostly composed with linen, and the clothing of the priest was mostly composed with linen, which also eliminates the whole discussion of did the priest wear a mixture of wool and linen. It seems to be that they, at least from this point of view, they didn't, which means that it wasn't that shatnez, which is not really clear what this word actually is or what its origins is. But obviously means a mixture, that the priest actually didn't wear this as if it's some kind of sanctified mixture of fabric that's only used by priests, as someone to argue, but really they didn't wear it at all. But the point is, but because the murex can't cling to the linen, it can be argued that really it's any type of blue. You don't really have to wear specifically for murex. And it's completely regardless of the whole discussion of murex being an unclean animal. We know as a fact people used it. So it wasn't as if that there was any question back then if you're allowed or not allowed to wear it. We do a lot of analogies when we read the Tanakh as people living thousands of years later. But in practicality, what we actually know from archaeology, which gives us a window into the real life of people, they had no problem using the blue, which was produced from murex. But obviously, it's a very expensive blue. A common person probably could not buy this type of blue and wear it all the time. And they will have to use fabrics which are dyed with plant dyes like the indigo. But in any case, another thing that people bring up here as well is Daber el Bnei Israel. Bnei Israel, is it sons of Israel, children of Israel? And you know, I've looked this up. I've seen people write arguments that it's only men have to wear tzitzit, and they go into all these games of what does the grammar actually mean and what does the word mean and so on. So we have to understand something. There are what we call idiomatic expressions, and there are figures of speech and so on. And when you look up the term Bnei Israel all over the Torah, you come to the realization it's used in a variety of ways, where sometimes, you know, he's speaking to all the people of Israel, and sometimes he's only speaking to the sons of Israel, only the males of Israel. But when it's only the males, when the commandment only relates to men, there's usually a focusing element there. For example, Kol Zachar, all the males, and so on. Like, for example, with the redemption of the firstborn. So all these hula hoops that people make and sometimes write very, very long papers are basically completely torn down by the fact that, first of all, Bnei Israel means children of Israel, which can also include women, children, elderly, and so on. And that's the common use of the term throughout the entire Torah. The other side of it is that the practice of women not wearing tzitzit is not necessarily something that's proven. I think that there's a very strong influence here of Jewish practice today, but there's no actually looking at what the Torah actually says. But even if you go into Jewish literature, you will find that women are allowed to wear tzitzit. And the only reason women don't wear tzitzit in Jewish practice is because there's a term called mitzvah shehazman grama, a commandment that's limited to a specific time. But again, this idea of is there a limitation, time limitation on tzitzit, stems from the idea of when it says in the verse "Viriitem oto," you will see it, either the blue or the tzitzit entirely, and probably the blue itself, and you'll remember. So at nighttime you don't see it. Therefore, the commandment is mute during the night, and therefore you don't have to wear tzitzit at night, which means that mitzvah is limited to a specific time frame, and therefore women are exempt from wearing tzitzit. But there's an inherent flaw with this argument. A, you have plenty of commandments which are limited to specific times, and women are anyhow commanded to do so. B, there is no limitation of when you wear your clothing, because people wore tzitzit on their actual clothing. It wasn't limited to like a talit or something. People wore it, if you wore a shirt, you put tzitzit on your shirt. Most men wore like a wrap-on skirt, and that was it. So they actually had tzitzit on the wrap-on skirt, and the people would wear this wrap-on skirt sometimes, you know, into the night as well. So there are inherent problems with this argument, and I think that the influence of Jewish practice has seriously influenced the way people understand this text, but there's actually nothing in the text that would indicate that women are not supposed to wear tzitzit. So in any case, you know, if a woman wants to wear tzitzit, Judaism allows it, period. There's another section here regarding the man who picks wood, and I really don't want to go beyond the time they usually limit these recordings. But the question that arises with the man who goes out to collect firewood is, what exactly is he charged with? There are a few opinions about this. First of all, I personally think that he went out to do an everyday life, mundane type of work, which is what the Torah forbids. And I will be doing a separate recording about Shabbat and how to define work on Shabbat and so on. But an argument that I keep on hearing from people is that he was punished because he was collecting firewood to make a fire. Now, the Torah in the book of Exodus says that it's forbidden to kindle a fire. The prohibition is to actually light the fire itself. So a friend of mine raised a question here about if the collecting of the wood is not the prohibition itself, but the prohibition is lighting the fire, then he actually hasn't done anything. This entire discussion goes into this whole philosophical realm of how they define certain things. But he raised this interesting question, and I'm just going to bring it up. I don't necessarily have a definite answer about this, but he said, if the prohibition is lighting the fire, and it's only lighting the fire, which is how people see it, at least from the ones I've spoken with, how is it that we're punishing this person that hasn't actually done anything yet? How can he punish if the action hasn't been done yet? If we have a person who's picking up his sword to go murder someone, but he hasn't murdered them yet, or he's only on the way and we stop him, can we convict him of attempted murder? You know, the Torah doesn't really see this concept of attempted murder. If you commit the murder, then you're guilty. If you injured the person, then you're guilty of something else. But you can't accuse a person of murder and put them to death. Okay? So it's an interesting subject here. And I think that really what we're looking at here is that a lot of the concept of what is Melacha on Shabbat is very vague to us. And I'll talk about this more in detail in another recording. But I personally think this man was actually punished for picking the wood. That the wood collection is prohibited as well. This gives us a bit of a window to understand what Melacha really is. In any case, I hope people enjoyed this recording. And as I always say, if you have any ideas for recordings or videos, or if you're interested in taking Hebrew lessons from me or Bible lessons as well through the Hebrew Scriptures, contact me at HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, or you can message me on the Facebook page or on the website. And again, I hope people enjoy these recordings, and God willing, we'll do them every week. Thank you.